The opinions expressed on the Fanalyze podcast are individual and are not necessarily representative of Spirit Live or Toronto Metropolitan University. Thank you for listening. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the second episode of the Fanalyze podcast. Today, we'll be covering a multitude of exciting topics, including the NHL's successful attempt to remake the All-Star Weekend via the Four Nations Face-Off, how the tournament has impacted the NHL trade markets just days before the trade deadline, and a look ahead to the biggest day of the NFL offseason with our very first mock draft. As a reminder, I'm one of your hosts. My name is Matthew.
My name is Joshua.
My name's Christina.
And I'm Miguel.
So the first topic we'll cover is the NHL's Four Nations Face-Off. First, Josh and I will give you a quick recap of the seven games in the tournament and their final scores. The first game kicked off in Montreal. It was Team Canada versus Team Sweden. Canada came away with a 4-3 overtime win, courtesy of Mitch Marner's goal. The second game was the USA versus Finland. The USA won 6-1 after a four-goal avalanche in the third period, with both the Tkachuk brothers scoring two goals each. The third game saw Finland beat Sweden 4-3 in overtime as well. There was less than 3 minutes on the clock when Finland scored to tie the game, and then they secured the overtime comeback. Canada versus the USA in the first game saw the United States win 3-1 in a game that was full of drama and fights, with Jake Guentzel and Dylan Larkin scoring the goals for the US, as well as Connor Hellebuck having a Vezina-worthy performance. The next game saw Canada beat Finland 5-3, although Granlund gave just about every Canadian hockey fan a heart attack at the end of the third period. Then we saw Sweden play the USA in the final game of the tournament before the finals, where both teams' backup goaltenders put on a show. Jake Oettinger with a .913 save percentage versus Samuel Ersson with a .970 save percentage in that 2-1 Sweden win. And that brought us to the finals. After the final round robin standing saw the US top the group, Canada come in second, Sweden third, and Finland fourth. As we all know now, Canada won in the finals 3-2 in overtime. It was a game of sweet revenge. Connor McDavid scored as winner, and Jordan Binnington came up with a huge performance in that final. What did you think, Josh?
I mean, what a great tournament overall. Like, there really wasn't any game that I could say wasn't entertaining. Like, even the low scoring events, like that 3-1 Canada versus USA game. Sure, it was maybe not the highest scoring game, but that was almost objectively the best game of the tournament. With those three fights in the first 9 seconds, holy, what a way to start! And then, I mean, yeah, that final game, that was a wild one, you know.
Definitely,
McDavid getting that overtime winner was huge for Canada, and it was almost as if like Crosby was sort of passing the torch to McDavid in that game.
Yeah, so now we'll turn it over to Christine and Miguel to give us some of the stats of the tournament's top performers.
I'll start off with the MVP of the Four Nations Face-Off, which was Nathan MacKinnon. He led all players with four goals in the tournament, and he scored in the opening goal against the final against America. I thought that was very impressive from Nathan MacKinnon, but, you know, high expectations for a player of his caliber.
Yeah, let's talk about the top performer, Connor McDavid, who scored the overtime goal to secure Canada's win in the Four Nations Face-Off Championship. Also, McDavid was one of the two skaters at the Four Nations Face-Off to record points in all four of their team's games.
And next up, we have Jordan Binnington. In between the pipes for Team Canada, he made 31 saves in the finals, including six crucial stops in overtime. I saw online there's some waivers. It's like, oh, please sign for apologies to Jordan Binnington. And I found it very funny, like, everyone had low hopes, but then he went beyond expectations.
Our next player, Zach Werenski, finishes as the Four Nations Face-Off leading scorer with 6 assists and 13 shots on goal.
Last for me, Joel Eriksson-Ek. He scored the tying goal in Sweden's first game against Canada, nearly becoming one of the heroes of the match.
And last player for me, Sidney Crosby, the Canadian captain who led the team and finished the tournament with 5 points.
So moving on, we'll address some of the events and drama that went down at the Four Nations Face-Off tournament. We'll try and avoid the politics of it because we know a lot of people actually turn to sports as an outlet from some of the hectic and more stressful things such as politics in our lives, but it's unavoidable that politics had a bit of an influence on this tournament. We heard stories of group chats and planning fights, a lot of chirps and pressers. Ultimately, that Canada-US game, the first one, was the pinnacle of drama, I would say, in the tournament. The final was much more subdued. It was a very exciting game in the same way, but there weren't the fights, of course. So Matthew Tkachuk and Brandon Hagel dropped the mitts first in that Canada-US game, right off the face-off. There's a lot of debate online about who actually won that fight. I can say, possibly as a biased Canada fan, watching it on TV, I thought Hagel won that fight to start. But apparently there are some people that think Tkachuk wiped the floor with him. The second fight, we saw Brady Tkachuk. He did beat Sam Bennett in that one. He's a heavy hitter. He's a big guy, so that wasn't necessarily a surprise. But it was the second fight in quick succession, literally right off of the second puck drop. And then finally, we saw JT Miller and Colton Parayko a little while after, and I think it's safe to say Parayko won that fight. We also saw at points, especially in the final, the anthem singer for Canada changed the lyrics at one point. So with all of this being said, I want to ask the three of you a question that came up. How much of that, especially in that first game of Canada and the U.S., how much of that was fueled from purely passion and a hockey rivalry between Canada and the U.S., and how much of it do you think might have been influenced by external events that built up the importance of the game?
Well, I think in the beginning, when we were singing the O Canada, right, there was a lot of booing in the start, but then it kind of slowed down. And I think most of that booing kind of came from Canada booing the American national anthem. And it was kind of like a retaliation, like, oh, you're booing us? Like, we're going to boo you back. And it wasn't really like, oh, you wouldn't normally see that, but I think that was a cause of the politics of what's going on. But other than that, I think the game to me seemed a lot more of just like the passion of Canada and America. And that's what the casters and Sportsnet really tried to play out.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with Miguel. I think a big part of these sports games are the atmosphere. And, you know, the fans bring that atmosphere and that passion to the game. And like you said, when they were booing the national anthems from both sides, that was very much so, I think, from a political standpoint, you know, with the tariffs and all that. But I think when it came down to the actual gameplay, I think that's just pure passion. Hockey players have to be some of the most passionate, hardcore athletes on the planet. And these guys really care for their countries. And they have so much pride in wearing their flag on that chest and on their jerseys. So, I think that is just purely almost like a hatred for the other country, but not in a political way. Like, this is the first time that we've had best on best hockey in a long time.
Yeah, for sure. When they're playing such an intense game like that, you want to fight for your country, and I think that comes from passion, not the politics.
Fair enough. Now we'll move on to what was more of a sports-centric debate following the Four Nations face-off. At the same time, the NBA All-Star Weekend was going on. And the NBA All-Star Weekend has received a lot of criticism over the last few years because people think it's becoming boring, it doesn't have the same draw, athletes don't take it seriously whatsoever. I can tell you that the Four Nations Face-Off Final had an average of 16 million viewers at a time, whereas the NBA only had 4.7. And when you consider that those are North America viewership stats, the fact that basketball is that far below hockey is a shocking statistic. That 4.7 million was a 13% decline from last year, which makes it the second least watched NBA All-Star game in the past 25 years. And I think what really played into it, the passion that the actual players had going into it. So Matthew Tkachuk went on Jimmy Kimmel after the Four Nations face-off, and he was asked to compare the Four Nations face-off, particularly the final, to winning the Stanley Cup final in Game 7 just last summer. And he said it really was such a big tournament and such a huge stage and something that he'll never forget. So he was admitting that he felt that the Four Nations Face-Off tournament for him and being able to represent the USA was bigger than winning the Stanley Cup for the Florida Panthers. If that's the energy and effort and passion that the players are willing to put into it, there's no surprise that you're getting a great product. Whereas Draymond Green, when he was asked about what he thought about the NBA All-Star Game's new format, he said, "This sucks, it ain't basketball." He also mentioned that the whole Rising Stars tournament concept was a bunch of undeserving people taking away from the true NBA All-Stars. So he clearly wasn't a fan of the format. And if that's what the players are going to put into that, there's no surprise that the product is not as good as the Four Nations Face-Off.
And I agree. I think that the All-Star game, the NBA All-Star game was honestly the same as it usually is, kind of like a joke. You have the dunk contest. You have the skills competition. Chris Paul and Wembanyama were just trolling, tossing the ball for their shots, right? It kind of just shows the lack of passion that people really have at the All-Star game. I mean, they really tried something they tried to experiment having this tournament style format, but I don't think it was enough to gain like the viewership and the attention from people. There isn't that passion in the All-Star weekend, and I think there usually was.
Yeah, for sure. I think there was not a lot of promotion compared to previous years. You heard everyone talking about the Four Nations, but there was no talk for the All-Star game, really.
It's just such a distinction between, you know, the Four Nations and the NBA All-Star Weekend, where the NBA All-Star Weekend is so individualistic. You know, it's almost as if, like, the players, they don't care about what team they're on. They're playing for themselves, especially during the skills competition. Like, those are individual, skills and activities. There's no drive to really work hard to help others around you also win.
Yeah, and if you compare it to not too long ago, last Olympics, America and France in the finals of the Olympics, that was very hype. Like, everyone enjoyed to see that. Maybe it was because it was the last time Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, and LeBron would play on the same team. But I've heard or I've seen some comments of players like, oh, maybe we should copy that Four Nations Face-Off in the NBA.
Yeah, and speaking of the basketball at the Olympics, I think this Four Nations Face-Off gives us a great preview to the 2026 Winter Olympics, where we will get best-on-best international hockey on a larger stage with more than just four countries, so I think hockey fans have a lot to look forward to. Okay, now we'll move on to a new segment. We're going to talk stocks. So essentially what we're going to do here is review, continuing off of the Four Nations Face-Off, review players' tournaments, and each of us are going to mention one player who we think their trade stock ahead of the NHL trade deadline has either risen or fallen, and we're going to give you a reason why.
I guess I can go ahead first. Now, this might shock a few people because he was just recently moved not too long ago, but I'm going to have Mika Rantanen, and I'm saying that his trade value just completely diminished. He's a faller for sure. Again, I know he was just traded, but there's been rumblings and rumors already about him being flipped before the deadline if he can't sign an extension with Carolina. And I don't know about you guys, but I haven't heard much about any contract talks other than like when he first got traded. But I don't think there's been much progress there. And he's struggled in Carolina, which has already hurt his trade value. And on top of that, he only had one goal in three games during the Four Nations Face-Off, lowering his value even more.
My riser is Brock Nelson from the Islanders. I think he's gotten more consistent in scoring. He's topped 34 goals in three straight seasons and is on pace for another 50-plus point season. Did you put this guy as a faller or what?
Yeah.
What? Okay. I guess we have some mixed opinions in this lobby here, but age, I mean, he's a little bit old, 33, but I mean, I think he still brings a lot to the table in terms of scoring, so.
I can tell you the reason I have Brock Nelson as a faller candidate, he played in four games at the Four Nations Face-Off. He had a -3 plus minus. He had three shots the entire tournament. He played 14-plus minutes time on ice average per game, so it's not like he wasn't having ice time. He just wasn't performing, and he finished the tournament with 0 points. So I think specifically from the Four Nations Face-Off performance, considering he was number one on TSN's trade bait board, his performance was very lackluster. I still think there are teams out there, you're right, he still offers great scoring ability, and he has some veteran leadership and not an awful contract. Obviously, he would be a rental considering his age. I think a team like the Leafs or Dallas, maybe Minnesota, Winnipeg are the kind of teams out there that would look for a guy like him. But solely based off of his Four Nations performance, I think his stock has fallen a little bit.
My riser is Bowen Byram. He's been playing with Dallin on the Sabres, very strong defense, showing that he's playing well and proving his worth on the ice. He's in a second year of a two-year contract worth $3.85 million AAV and will become a restricted free agent at the end of the season. Given this performance, he's due for a significant rise, which Buffalo may struggle to afford. He would be a great addition to any team. However, getting him to stay with the Sabres will definitely be expensive, and he'll likely demand a salary of a top pair defenseman next season.
Okay, and I'll mention one last riser here. Jordan Binnington. He's a guy that we've mentioned already. In four games played of the Four Nations faceoff, he got three wins, and I know some people will argue whether wins is really a goalie stat, but three wins, 2.37 goals against average, but a .907 save percentage. He had a little over an hour more time on ice than any other goalie in the tournament. He had the most goals allowed, but that makes sense considering how much he played and the number of shots he faced. But Jordan Binnington would be a good fit for a bunch of different teams looking for a relatively affordable top-tier goalie. There have been a lot of people saying they want Jordan Binnington to be on their team. The four teams that I was able to come up with based on my research were the Bruins, Oilers, Hurricanes, and Red Wings as his top suitors. Whether St. Louis will actually want to let him go, considering his Four Nations performance, is questionable. But St. Louis are outside of the Western Conference wildcard by a fairly decent amount. The Western Conference wildcard race is not anywhere near as tight as the Eastern Conference, so St. Louis could look to be big sellers at the deadline, and Binnington could be moving teams.
It's one of the most exciting times of the NFL offseason, the NFL draft. Matthew and Josh have put together their own NFL mock draft, where they'll break down who they think will go where. Whether you're a diehard fan or just love the draft excitement, we've got all the prediction covered. Let's dive right in.
All right, so the way we're going to format this is Josh and I have divided up the top picks. He'll choose the odd numbers, I'll choose the even numbers. We are essentially assuming the role of NFL GMs. We don't know who each other have picked where, so we will have to react accordingly. And that way we'll build out what we believe to be the most authentic draft and not just matching one of our ideals.
And with the first overall pick in the 2025 NFL Draft, the Tennessee Titans select Cam Ward. So my reasoning behind this is the Titans lack a true number one QB. Like, I don't remember the last time they had a true number one QB. Like, can we say Ryan Tannehill was a true number one QB? He had a couple good seasons, but like, he wasn't anything crazy. And right now, like, Will Levis just doesn't do it for me. And Ward, I think he's a bit more complete than Sanders is. I think he's got more accuracy on his long balls and more of an arm strength. So I think that's why I'm taking Cam Ward.
Yeah, and I think we've heard more than a lot of trade speculation surrounding the Tennessee Titans' first overall pick, but I agree with you. I think they would be best advised to stand put at the number one pick and take the quarterback that they feel the best about. And I've heard a lot of the pro comparisons for Cam Ward being like Dak Prescott or Geno Smith, which I think are some respectable NFL starter names. So I can agree with your Cam Ward pick at number one. That's where I would have gone too. Now, with the second pick in our first 2025 NFL mock draft, the Cleveland Browns select Shedeur Sanders, quarterback, Colorado. The reason I'm taking Shedeur Sanders here is the Browns do need a quarterback. They could look at other positions, like defensive line. If Miles Garrett walks, they might want Abdul Carter. Travis Hunter is a generational talent, but the Browns need a quarterback. And even players within their own locker room, they've been trying to beat around the bush, but we all know the ugly quarterback situation they've got on going on there. Greg Newsome, Denzel Ward, and company know that the Browns need a quarterback. And if they want to keep Miles Garrett, they need to win. And how do you win? With an elite quarterback. The last two seasons, we've seen CJ Stroud, who is Shedeur Sanders' pro comp, and Jaden Daniels last year with the Washington Commanders end up going on playoff runs. Stroud's been to back-to-back divisionals, and in Daniels' rookie season, he obviously went to the NFC Championship game. Sanders last year had his best year of college ball, and his quarterback rating in the end was a 168.2, which is a great number. 37 touchdowns to just 10 interceptions. He cleaned up a lot of his issues, over 4,000 yards. Everybody who talks about Sanders seems to really enjoy him. Andrew Berry said that he had a chance to spend some time with Shedeur at the East-West, and will get some time to spend with him during the upcoming week, he said at the Scouting Combine earlier this week. He's a fantastic individual, really smart, really driven, grew up around football and was highly successful. It's been a pleasure to spend time with him. We're looking forward to spending more over the next several weeks. So everybody seems to see Shedeur Sanders as a very impressive individual and the most NFL-ready quarterback in this draft, and that's what the Browns need to do. They need to get a player in place to help them win as soon as possible. So I take Shedeur Sanders at number 2.
And yeah, that's a great pick. And I would have taken Sanders with my next pick if he wasn't already taken. So you kind of stole my guy. But I do have a backup plan here. And the 3rd overall pick belongs to the New York Giants. And I have them taking Travis Hunter. And I know, like, Abdul Carter is still on the board here. And although he is a great player, the Giants need for a quarterback, a cornerback is greater than their need for an edge, in my opinion. And if you could possibly get like a wide receiver out of him as well, right? Like, that's just an added bonus. And I think the consensus is that he's going to end up playing cornerback. And that is just a massive need, I think, for the Giants. So that's why I have him going 3rd overall.
Yeah, and in terms of his offensive stats last year, I know a lot of GMs see him as a cornerback first, but he still put up 15 touchdowns and over 1,200 yards. So definitely a quality receiving option. And in doing some of the research for this mock draft, his pro comps, I know I've mentioned Dak and Geno for Cam Ward. Travis Hunter's pro comps were Charles Woodson and Deion Sanders. Those are two Hall of Famers. So I think Travis Hunter has a bright future in this league, and I think pairing him up on an offense with Malik Nabers and giving the Giants a defensive star will do wonders. Okay, moving on to the next pick. With the 4th overall pick in our first 2025 NFL mock draft, the New England Patriots select Abdul Carter, defensive end, Penn State. I think for the Patriots here, it's got to be best player available. And I think Abdul Carter at this point is the best player left on the board. I think in the draft, they could see Travis Hunter there. They could see quarterbacks there. They're not going to take a quarterback. They're well situated with Drake May. But Abdul Carter had himself a season, 12 sacks. And he's not necessarily solely an edge rusher. He's the kind of guy that I think would be comfortable playing at outside linebacker in the NFL, which would give him some versatility, and his playmaking skills can shine. A lot of his pro comps were to Danielle Hunter or a ceiling like Micah Parsons, which I think would be very enticing to help build up the Patriots defense. That's offense is now getting settled. And again, Mike Vrabel, their new head coach, Vrabel loves to run a good defense, and his best seasons in Tennessee saw the team with being top 10 in takeaways and having elite run defenses. And I think that's what Abdul Carter will help replicate in New England under the new Mike Vrabel regime.
And yeah, again, another great pick. I think a common theme here for the first like 4 picks is you can't really go wrong. Like, you could make an argument for all of these players going number 1 overall, honestly.
Absolutely.
So I think if you're in a top 4 position here, like, you can't go home crying. You know, you're probably going to go home with a franchise altering player. Like, these guys are just that good. But the 5th overall pick belongs to the Jaguars, and I have them going with Mason Graham. Now, the Jaguars, I mean, what can you say about the Jaguars? They need help on both sides of the ball. Like, you could go with an offensive player or a defensive player, and it'll help them greatly because they're just an absolute dumpster fire on both sides right now. But, you know, with Liam Cohen coming in, who's the former Bucks offensive coordinator, as their new head coach, and a QB in Trevor Lawrence, who has shown flashes of greatness. We know he can be great. I think defense is just the priority for the Jags right now. And Graham had a solid year, 3.5 sacks, 24 solo sacks, and he almost doubled his assisted tackles from the 2023 seasons with 22 assisted tackles in 2024. So I think if, you know, you have Trevor Lawrence have a bounce back year with the new coach coming in, and you have Mason Graham coming in on your defensive side, then you have the potential for a little bit of a bounce back season from the entire team. So that's why I have Mason Graham going 5th overall to the Jaguars.
Yeah, and a lot of scouting reports on Mason Graham just say disruptive, disruptive, disruptive. So I think he's a great piece to add to the defensive line in Jacksonville. And with that being said, we thank you for tuning in to the second Fanalyze podcast episode. Next week, we'll obviously cover some of the latest news, including a feature segment on The Great Chase. And we'll also be debuting a bunch of new segments that test our fandom and take into account some of your opinions. We'll see you next week.